Okay, let's go.
I want to welcome everybody. I see some new faces from the community. You're more than welcome to attend this lecture and any subsequent lecture, so feel free to come by whenever you want. No need to ask. You're always welcome. I'm Dave Jaffe, in case you haven't seen me before. I sort of organize this class with help from others. So just wanted to see if there's any questions about any material from last week. If not, we'll move ahead. I have some items that we'll talk and discuss before getting into the lecture. First of all, I want to hand out these programs from the Haas Center for Public Service and have Karen Cotterman say something about it, since she's from that facility.
Hi. Thanks for being here tonight. I'm an associate director for the Gates Fellowship, so I actually work with faculty on creating service learning courses, so we're happy to sponsor this course as well as others. This brochure going around outlines student opportunities for involvement with the Haas Center. It's also all available via our website for those who might be interested. And, specifically, I'd like to say that tonight at 7, for those of you who are interested and available, there's a lecture by Professor Rob Reich on ethics and service that might be of interest to some folks who are enrolled in this class as well. So I'm Karen Cotterman, K-A-R-I-N-C, at Stanford. I'm available via the website, and all of this information is also there. Thanks, and
okay.
Thanks for the class.
Welcome. This is a part of our continuing discussion on who is disabled, and as you may recall, I do these things not so much as to label people with disabilities, but to engage in some discussion. And I sort of brought this up on my lecture on the first day. So what we do is read through this a line at a time and determine if the person is disabled or not. And at the end, we engage in a little discussion. So we have a group of very intelligent and motivated young adults. Don't have jobs, so that's sort of a negative aspect. And they're an extreme financial burden to their families. That's a financial condition. Undereducated or not optimally educated. They don't have degrees, and they don't have any employment prospects. When you look at all those things and you say, well, this is a person who's may not be much of a benefit to society, but you find out that there are Stanford students, or in this case, over here, Michigan students, because that's where I went to school. The question comes up, are students really disabled because of their position or not? What do you think? I see some. Do you have a comment? So you don't.
The term disabled.
Okay, right.
Put it in that context.
Because. Right. Well, we define disability as a health-related condition. So this isn't really a health-related, but it's education-related. It's financially related, and other things. But it sort of brings up the question. You're maybe after you graduate, you're in a better shape. So that sort of brings up the idea to me, at least, that during your life you get more and more able through your education and more employable, at some point in your life you'd be able to really benefit society. But as you're getting there, you're sort of suboptimal, you're subprime. So that's an interesting condition. So in thinking about that, is just being like young a disability? A baby, an infant, certainly they're pretty helpless. But we don't normally consider, a baby being disabled.
Maybe disadvantaged.
Disadvantaged?
Not a baby. I'm going back to students.
Oh, the students are disadvantaged. Well, if they're going to Stanford, are they disadvantaged?
No. Because if they don't have a job yet.
Okay.
Okay.
But after you are get your diploma and you have a job, you know, maybe, you know, you get later in life and you're retired. Does that mean you're sort of going downhill on the other side of the hill? I mean, is there a progression, you know, from being totally dependent when you're an infant to being sort of optimal and in your prime, you know, physically and educationally and money-making capacity, and then sort of tapers off near the end of your life? Oh, okay. I'm sorry to bring that up then. Do you have a comment? No? Okay, well, you know, it's something to think about because, you know, you think, you know, are people that are elderly, you know, disabled just because they're old? You know, maybe not.
Maybe they're wise enough not to do dumb things anymore.
Okay, so there's so if you graph wisdom versus time, you know, maybe that's ever increasing.
Ill-equipped might be another term.
Ill-equipped? Okay, so it's a matter of preparedness for being in society. That's a good comment. Okay, let's go on to the next one. I just thought of this one this year. But it doesn't relate to actually anybody at Stanford, actually. But I'm just using that as an example. A world-class professor is hired by Stanford. He has an excellent educational program, but he's overwhelmed with administrative responsibilities. And that prevents him from really participating in his courses and relating to his students and colleagues. Now, I know some examples of this, not necessarily at Stanford, but at other facilities. And it seems like, you know, some people are just overly busy with mundane administrative things. So, you know, to me, it's a form of disability where you really can't leverage all your opportunities and really do a great job. You're sort of held back by the system. Does anybody know of people in that category? Or are you yourself in that category? Karen, you're sort of laughing.
There's moments that feel like
yeah, there's moments. So if you're really busy and you can't do the things that you want to do, I mean, that's sort of a disabling condition, don't you think? I mean, I know people that, I want to get in touch with, but they, you know, for weeks and weeks, and they just say, you know, I was in the middle of this exam or accreditation or writing a grant proposal or something, and so they're just you know, you can't communicate with them, and so that's sort of a negative thing. Wayne.
Based on which you've a couple of slides before, what you said there, it almost seems like anyone would be considered disabled if they're a certain percentage out of phase with the society that they're expected to function in.
Oh, okay.
So in other words, if I were put in a hunting society where you had to use bow and arrows to feed yourself, I'd be in trouble because I couldn't go to the local supermarket.
So there are norms and expectations of society that define able-bodied or what a normal person should do?
I think so, to some extent. I mean, there are probably other factors that precede that, but I think for a great extent that's probably true.
Okay.
You know.
I would agree with that. Does anybody know who this is a picture of besides Professor Nelson? Oh, yeah, well, you would know. You're right. This is Fred Terman, who you know, we're in the Terman Engineering Center, which is going to be torn down eventually. So I thought it'd be a good idea to show his picture. Finally, this is sort of comes out of this class. An individual with limited financial means has a severe disability for which there's no cure and no current assistive devices available to restore their lost functionality. But there's a student team who have fabricated a new assistive device for this individual, maybe from this class. And so they develop a prototype, but it's not commercially available, so maybe that person can't benefit from it. But the students decide to form a company and attract some venture capital and bring it to market. Okay, that sounds good, but the health insurance company decides not to pay reimbursement for it. So the person is back in the same situation that there's something on the market that can help them, but they have no way of getting it. And, you know, there's a lot of examples of this that I know of. So So in this case, you know, who's disabled? Well, the person may end up, you know, still being in need of some assistive technology, but the system is disabled in that it may not be able to provide that device for a person who needs it. And maybe the reason is that device is too expensive. Here's one example, you know, the iBot wheelchair made by Dean Kamen came up with that, and that was sort of the prelude to the Segway. So this was a device that he developed, and it was very well engineered, as well as the Segway was. And it was on the market, and as I mentioned, it sold for $25,000, but at that price, they were losing money on each one. So the market was bad, and nobody was buying them. It was too expensive, and even though it could have helped a lot of people, it's finally off the market now. So just because you have a well-engineered device with a lot of money behind it, and it cost, that device cost $500 million to develop, believe it or not. So despite all that money and all that time and all that engineering, you have a device that, you know, didn't really make it to the market and really didn't benefit anybody. It did.
No, I mean, I had that chair for about a month before, and there was still too much lacking. There was still so much things that you had to maneuver with the chair and, you know, link it up with the computer and done that every night. And it didn't bridge the gap. I mean, if the product would have been perfect, it would have been the chair is there. You would have been in a different situation.
Right.
So there's still some time left.
Right. It's as I mentioned, the rehab market is very strange, and because of its because of the individualization and customization that's required. So I want to end my discussion with this little music video, and this is actually a something I found on the internet, and I actually know some of the people who made it, but it's from the point of view of a consumer, and he or she is talking about their needs and how they want assistive equipment to be made. So let's see if I can get this to run. Here it is here. Do it this way. Are you ready?
Set the price so I can buy. Give me places where I can even try. I want choices like my sisters and brothers. I want to choose one from the other. Give me time. And clean, a functional machine, sweet, sweet, assistive technology. Technology, I'll tell you what it means to me. Technology, technology, it's my key to being free. Dear teachers, who can teach us? When I'm ready to reach, let me reach. I want to work first thing in the morning and never break down without warning. Building durable and flexible and friendly, make it rugged, tough and sexy, make it trendy. And if you want to know how it should be, why don't you just ask me, sweet, sweet, assistive technology. Technology, I'll tell you what it means to me. Technology, technology, it's my key to being free. Let me roll, slip, ripple, and glide. Push the feelings that I'm holding inside. Well, it's my access to the frigid page. And my
keep it like a solid game. Well, it's the way that I can reach and stand. My eyes, my ears, my legs, and my hands. It's my key to the highway so wide. So it's my ace, my ticket to ride. Technology, I'll tell you what it means to me. Technology, it's my key to being free. Sweet, sweet, assistive technology.
Yeah. What do you think?
Awesome.
Yeah.
Did that just get made for Resna?
That's what?
Did it get made for Resna?
I don't think so. It was made for Resna. Okay, I just want to say that on Thursday, we're going to have the student presentations, midterm presentations, and you're all welcome to attend and listen and evaluate and give support and suggestions for improvement and applause for performance and things like that. So that'll be Thursday. But today we have direct from beautiful Minden, Nevada, Peter Axelson making his fourth appearance in this class. And Peter is has been a student at Stanford, both undergraduate and graduate, and he was at the VA, you know, with me, and so I had the, I think I've known him for over 30 years now, so that's a long time. And he was in the Air Force Academy, and in 1981 he founded Beneficial Designs, an engineering firm dedicated to designing, developing, and testing assistive technologies. And his accomplishments include developing the first chairlift compatible monoski system with the shock absorber. And he's done a lot of work to establish wheelchair standards. And continues to do so. He's developed a number of seating systems for wheelchairs and created a system to assess trails that will improve access to outdoor trails for people of all ages. And he's been doing a lot of traveling. And he's an avid pilot. He flew his own adaptive plane in yesterday into San Jose Airport. And he's an active monoskier. And perhaps more importantly, he's just been, just last week he was selected to be on the U.S. delegation for the closing ceremony of the Winter Olympics. So before you see him become even more famous, you'll see him here. So if you're ready to go, I'll pass the microphone over to you. Kathy, there you go, you're on.
So what I thought I'd do is kind of just show you where Beneficial Designs is and kind of show you some of the projects that we've done, starting, you know, right from basically coming out of Stanford, because I started Beneficial Designs while I was in Stanford, and share some of the design work that I've done in products, and then sort of maybe skip to some of the work that we're doing right now in the past year and the things that we're working on, and share a little bit about that. And if somebody's got a specific quick question about something, you could just raise your hand and I'll try to answer the question, because you might not see it again, or if you want to write it down and ask me about it a little bit later. I just have one handout that does have my email address on the back there. So if you wanted to ask me a question or contact me by email, we have students that come and do internships occasionally at Beneficial Designs, and that's how some people have started their work there. And I'm hoping that you'll enjoy what we have to share. And exactly how long do I have, Dave?
Until 5:30.
Okay. So we're going to fly along pretty fast here through these slides. I'm going to see if I can do this once more and see them here and there. No? Yeah, there we go. Okay, that makes it easier. This is my wife, Denise Axelson, and myself. I have to admit and recognize that Denise is also a rehab engineer, and she's kind of the super organized, detail-oriented, keeps everything all glued together and organized person, and I'm sort of the wild free thinker, always trying to add new things, like Dave heard. You know, it's like, Dave, could you have my office email the presentation they were working on this morning? And so together we work, you know, really well together. And Denise has set up a lot of systems in our company, and we worked as together as rehab engineers for 10 years. And then we said, you know what, I should marry that girl. And so we've been married now about 10 years, coming up on our 10th anniversary here. So. So Denise is in the top right there, who is mostly being a mom now. We have a little girl in kindergarten that we adopted, so that's been a pretty exciting thing in our lives lately. So I just want to let you know, just sometimes everybody always wonders, well, how'd you end up in a wheelchair? So I'll just get that out there real quick. I got hurt in a rock climbing accident when I was at the Air Force Academy in 1975. So this is almost 35 years ago, and I fell 165 feet, one of those things where everything that could and got wrong did. I fell through an 85-foot tree that broke my fall, and it's kind of a miracle that I survived. And I've always had just a real strong faith and belief that everything that happens in my life happens for a purpose, and so I basically accepted where I was and charged ahead with sort of thinking about what I could still do. A lot of people that lose function or become disabled in some way, you can focus on all the things that you can't do, because there's so many things that you can't do. So you could get busy thinking about the 10,000 things you can do, and my thinking is to just focus on the 1,000 things that I still can do. And so that's how I came into Stanford when I came out to finish my education, and the paths that I've gone on with my work have all been related to what are the things that I still can do. And actually, it was a lot of them things that, well, maybe I could do this if I could design the equipment that I needed to go out and do this or that. So you're going to see a lot of equipment that I basically designed to be able to try and do things that I otherwise wasn't able to do. So first I'm just going to introduce you to everybody I work with. This is Bill in the top right there. Is our wheelchair testing, sort of coordinates all the wheelchair testing that we do. Jeremy coordinates all the trails work that we do, and you're going to hear more about both those things. Shauna is our one employee that still lives in Santa Cruz. We used to be in Santa Cruz. We've been in Minden now since 2001. She is a researcher and still works for us out of Santa Cruz, our bookkeeper there. This is Barton. He's our electronics computer guy that can design circuits and things to do things that I have. That's Dave's expertise. When I was a student, Dave helped me along in that area as well, just getting the electronics part of what I'm doing to work. This is Harmony, our office manager. And Jamie, we have some students that work in our office, since Jamie's one of our students. And there's Jeremy out working with our digital roller wheel. And Steven, who's loading up a wheelchair test dummy there. That's one of our electronics work areas. And we have, you know, like any other office, we got lots of paperwork and a library. But we have some strange machines that we've built. This is a wheelchair double drum tester. And those drums go around and round and round, and the slats hit the wheels of the the wheelchair, and we have to pretty much design and build most of this machinery that we use for testing. This is a passive multi-drum tester, so for like these powered wheelchairs that are mid-wheel drive with front wheels and rear wheels, this allows the wheelchair to drive the drums to do the testing. This is a drop test machine. It uses pneumatics to pick the wheelchair up, and then it just physically drops it about 2 inches. And we do that like 7,000 times on a wheelchair. We do the drum testing about 200,000 times. That's a electric tilt platform. We put the wheelchair on there and load it up and measure the static stability of the wheelchair. And lots of parts and bead blasters and powder coating ovens and, you know, all the shop tools that you would have in any sort of prototyping shop. We're not really set up for production, but we can bring a wheelchair in and take it all apart and put new anti-tippers on there and see if we can design it to be more stable and more safe when we're testing them. We also do some clinical testing when we're testing products. When we test our products, it's really important to calibrate your test subjects. If you don't have your test subjects calibrated to known references, you have no idea where those people fit in terms of their fitness level relative to the general population. So we'll do a PWC 170 test to predict somebody's peak heart rate, you know, peak maximum output. And then when we're testing them, we know what percentage of their max output they're working at. That's really helpful when we're developing standards for surfaces, for ramps, for grades, for trails, and all that sort of thing. We have a lot of seat cushions. We do testing. We've done a lot of wheelchair seating design work. This is our calibration fixture for calibrating test dummies. We put the chair, the dummy in there, and we shift that test dummy until we get the center of mass in the exact spot that our standard specifies it's supposed to be for a given weight. These are a couple of our trail gate barriers that we're working on. We're working on ways to allow wheelchairs and other mobility devices to get on recreation trails, but to keep the motorcycles out when they're not supposed to be there. So we're doing some experimentation with that. We've got a canoe on a machine here and an ergometer. We've been designing some canoe seating. And we've got some baby jogging strollers there, and I'm going to tell you what that's about a little bit later. And this is the other part of our test lab out at the airport. This is inside of a hangar. We've got a big giant ramp that we bring up in the air, and we flip the wheelchairs over backwards and see if we can flip them over sideways or backwards and forward to try to make sure that they're safe and stable under all operating conditions. And so there's only about a dozen of these test labs all over the world. There's four of them in the United States, and we're one of those test labs. So that's a brief tour of some stuff in our facilities. And now I'm going to go to my next one, which is BD Projects. And I'm going to show you some projects that I've been working on. And slideshow. So the first thing we're going to look at is this was my student project. This is the Arroyo Sitski. And this was something that I worked on while I was a student here. I got taken out in this little plastic sled at Winter Park Ski Area, and it was like going down the hill on a lunch tray. And I said, I think I can make this work better. And so we designed edges under it, underneath, to give control. So when you lean forward, you could turn, and it would track straight when you lean back. And right away, people, you know, all the professors saying, who's going to want to do this? And I got all these letters, and people were saying, we want to do this. And we had competitions going on in these things. And we did sit skiing for quite a while. Oops, I don't know what happened to my monoski. We'll see that in a minute. Another project that I got to supervise was a hand cycle. Doug Schwantz, not here this year. Some of you may know him. He developed this hand cycle, and there's a tandem version. I wanted to be able to lean just like a regular bicycle, to be able to steer and lean. Okay, there's the monoski. So in 1984 and 85, I started building these monoskis, and I had a spring in it, but I didn't have a dampener in it. And I got tossed on tea over tea kettle, separated my shoulder. This has got to work better than this. So we got a snowmobile-type shock absorber and put that in the monoski. And we designed the first monoski in the world with a latch to load safely on and off a chairlift, and also with molded seating. And that is why, actually, I was chosen to be part of this presidential delegation to the closing ceremony at the Olympics. Not, you had to be a gold medal winner, but you also had to have done some other significant things, I think. So I'm going to get to be there with Christy Yamaguchi and all these other cool athletes and officials from the United States. So I raced from 1985 to 1992 and raced in three world championships. And underneath what I'm wearing on my ski, I have this, see that fiberglass rod back there that's flexed in the back that's attached to the back of my seat? This goes through a tube in my back. Basically, I can flex in any direction I want because I have some stomach muscles, and that fiberglass rod brings me back up. I don't have any back muscles. Without it, I just sort of be slumped over on top of my knees. So it's a sort of an artificial back muscle for my ski. And that works really, really well for that, and people have been building this for other things. There's diagrams of this on our website. And I just want to mention, when we design recreation technology that's high-risk, technology that we can't afford to get product liability insurance on, we purposely put it in the public domain so nobody can patent it, and then anybody else can copy it, make it, manufacture it. And that's pretty much how all these monoskis are being manufactured. There's small companies that are making and manufacturing these designs. And so that's how it's available. This is a new cross-country ski I'm working on. It's articulated, and it has bungee cords in it. And I was just up skiing in a 2 weekends ago on a full moon, when we had the full moon up in Hope Valley up there, and it's working really well. It's for track skiing, first going fast and racing, and you get increased range of motion with that spring that sort of kicks me fore and aft. This is a back support that I designed that's on my wheelchair. It was manufactured by Invacare, and now it's going to be manufactured by a company in the United Kingdom. And it increases my sitting height about an inch and a half because it's a lower lumbar, upper sacral type of support that kicks the pelvis into a more upright position. When I'm outside and going downhill, I reach back and I loosen it so that I can lean back more so I don't fall over going downhill in my chair. But I find it works really well. It's not, I don't have to put a whole back system into my wheelchair that I have to take in and out. It just folds up with the wheelchair. Just a lot of things I've done for my own wheelchair. I have little wheels that I use because I don't like aisle chairs getting on and off airplanes. So I just pull my wheels off, I go down the aisle, and I get on the plane. I keep my wheelchair on the plane. So on the long-distance flights, I can get it out, and I can use it to go to the bathroom on the aircraft. I designed some of this balance seating that was invented in the Scandinavian countries. I made a balance seat so I could sit in that at my desk in this sort of forward open motorcycle posture, some therapists call it, to be able to sit. I made a wheelchair that sits that way, and this wheelchair had several postures. You could sit back, and the front wheel would lift up, and you can maneuver, but it had two main wheels and one caster in the front and rear. And this is the seat cushion that I'm sitting on today. It's contoured just for my bones. It's a urethane foam on the bottom with a Tempur foam soft squishy foam on the top, and it works really, really well. And I use that in the car. I have some of these in the car and in my aircraft that I fly and in my wheelchair. This is a gel butt that designed with Alan Siegman to test wheelchair cushions, and we load them with this to measure them for the standardization process. We put pressure mats under them, and we measure how well cushions work by comparing them. And we've helped a lot of companies develop products for wheelchair cushions and seating. This is a thing called the hip grip that BodyPoint Design sells. Jamie Noon and Alan did most of the design work on this. It's a spring-loaded thing that grabs onto the pelvis. And so for someone that has spasticity, they can spasm and go way out of posture, and then it brings them back into a good upright posture. Also, wheelchair athletes that play tennis and stuff that want to reach forward, it allows them to reach forward, and it helps pull them back into position. So it's kind of a spring-loaded thing that holds onto the pelvis. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing that at the request of the company manufacturing
Yes. Yeah.
I think that was a government sort of sponsored study.
Well, the wheelchair testing is now required by CMS for coding, for Medicare, for powered wheelchairs. You have to get the product tested in an independent lab in the United States because we can't trust the Asian testing we found. So it has to be tested, and then we give the test results. They turn it into an organization that codes the product and determines how much that manufacturer is going to get reimbursed for that product. So that's for scooters and powered wheelchairs that that's done for. The VA has just started requiring the standards for testing wheelchairs and scooters for the Veterans Administration as well. And then the FDA requires all powered wheelchairs to be tested to these standards to show that you have a device that's safe, because powered wheelchairs are Class 2 medical devices. So these standards, which are all RESNA standards, are all getting integrated into the system slowly. This is a wheelchair hand rim called the Flex Rim. I have some of these on my chair, and Spinergy is manufacturing them. The hand rim is connected to the wheel with a thin layer of urethane rubber, so you can squeeze through a very narrow doorway. And then if our hands are not gripping so well, like mine, left hand especially doesn't grip so well, it basically I can push without gripping at all, because I just push my hand into that rubber and I don't have to grip that slippery aluminum hand rim with my hand. This is another design that Mark and I came up with called a grip rim. There's a rubber thing around the hand rim and there's little plastic pieces in there, so it slides when you're going downhill, but if you push on it, the rubber pushes through and grips the hand rim inside. So when you're pushing it, you just squeeze and push it, but when you want to go downhill, you have to do sort of push against the sides of it, and you can break that way. And that hasn't made it to the market yet. I guess I'll leave it at that. We worked on some adaptive canoe seating, and that's currently available through a company called Chosen Valley Canoe Accessories, and they're manufacturing these adaptive seats for all the water sports programs. There's a lot of disability outdoor recreation programs that use adaptive seating because if they can get people into a boat, they can go anywhere. And so a lot of programs are taking people with various disabilities and impairments out on water sport activities. Just to show you a couple of things we do when we're evaluating, we set up this canoe on rollers so we could put our subjects in there, and then Kathy's measuring how far this subject can tilt with the smart level, seeing how far they can tilt with the seat, standard seating that's available, and then the seat they're designing. So we're always trying to objectively prove how much more efficient or inefficient our work is compared to what's out there. And then, of course, we were doing a wet exit test to make sure they could still safely get out of the canoe when we're putting all these lateral supports and everything in there on the seating. So that's what the finished seat looks like on the right there. It actually has changed since then, now that it's evolving as a product on the marketplace. And there's a molded seat on the kayak on the left. Now, we started looking at how do we make the outdoor recreation environment accessible, and we developed what's called the Universal Trail Assessment Process. What we use are some simple tools, compass and clinometer, to measure grades and cross slopes, and smart level to measure the trail. And then to make that process, we've trained 1,000 people in this manual assessment process where two people go out and manually assess the trail for grade, cross slope, surface, tread width, and obstructions. And that information is created in the signage, and I'll show you some of that. But it's not that efficient because it's pretty slow and it requires two people. So we took a jogging stroller and we instrumented it with a bunch of sensors so we could automatically measure the grade and the cross slope and the distance and the GPS position and the camera images as we go down the trail to capture information about trails. To measure the surface, we needed to design an objective way to measure how firm and stable the surface is. So this is called a rotational penetrometer. You stand on it. You release a precision spring, it dents into the surface, and then a precision caliper measures how far it indents. And then you twist the tire four times back and forth. And if the surface is unstable, it digs in a lot more. So we get a firmness reading and a stability reading. So if you go to the Access Board website and look under the research papers under accessibility of outdoor surfaces, you'll see the report on our work there. and we're writing an ASTM standard to use this device for measuring accessibility of any type of surface, for everything from carpets to playground surfaces to tent sites and trails. So it's going to be real helpful for the access board to determine what firm and stable surfaces are. Then to process all our data, we created this software called Trailware, and you can put parks in there and trails and lots of detailed information. And then we can create what we call trail access information. This is sort of summary information about a trail. It's like a nutrition facts label in a way, because we've got the typical grade information up here. We've got the typical grade is 2.6%, but 5% of the trail is 8 to 20%, and then 160 feet of the trail is 12 to 20%. So you can see what the worst grades are on the trail, what the typical grades are for grades and cross slopes and tread width. You can see the minimum clearance widths. And this is what we call our trail access information signpost that we put on trails. And it's actually patterned right after the nutrition food facts label. And we have all the information lined up on a strip there to put on our trail. Then we also have the data. People are putting the data onto this website, so you can search for trails on the website. And so you can go in and say, I want a trails that go to waterfalls, and I want them that are less than this grade or wider than this certain tread width. And then it'll show you the trails, and then you can click on that and get the detailed information about that trail. Now, I mentioned the trail gate barrier. I showed you we're trying to, on trails that aren't supposed to have motorized vehicles on them, we're trying to figure out how to keep the motorized vehicles off, but allow the mobility devices that should be on the trail on the trail. So by coming up with this weird profile, we've been able to figure out how to do this for 99% of the cases. And then we've got an electronic system as well. So I'm going to escape from that set of slides. Any questions so far on what you've seen? So what you're seeing is our company sort of moving from products, moving more into making the environment more accessible. In other words, using universal design principles to sort of make everything more accessible for people that want to go out and do things. This is the view on the other side of the Sierras, where our office is there. And so the issue is sort of what makes a trail accessible. And, you know, I've talked about the surface. Surface is probably the greatest factor in making something accessible, because if surface is soft, it's really tough to get through that surface. That makes it very difficult to get through. But if it's not wide enough, you're not going to get through either. But you can get a little bit of help up to steep spots or, you know, whatever around certain areas. But if it's a soft surface the whole way, you're in for a rough trip. So what's happened is our company helped develop some accessibility guidelines for trails with a bunch of different exceptions, and I'm going to skip the exceptions real quick. And they apply to trails and outdoor recreation access routes. And I'm going to talk about how we measure the firmness and stability with that device. And you can see an example here. For example, see the decomposed granite? It's really, really firm. 0.18 is a very low indentation, but the stability is really bad. 0.83, it's almost going in an inch once you twist it around in there. And you can see, like, this Enviro GeoWeb is like 0.44 inches. So that's a firm and stable surface. So we're finding that there's these things that we can add to the trail tread to sort of stabilize the surface, to create sort of a matrix in the trail surface to make it firm and stable. I'm going to skip some of the specs on the technical things. And then what we're also working on is how to measure all the other elements in the outdoor recreation environment. Everything from camp, you know, picnic tables and benches to campfire grills. And, you know, I know this doesn't seem very glamorous as far as, like, research, but you wouldn't believe, if you go on the internet and look at for, like, accessible picnic tables, 95% of the ones that are being sold on the internet as being accessible to meet standards are not accessible, because they don't, there's a mismatch between understanding the specifications, which are very technically written about how much knee clearance there needs to be and how deep it is and how much foot clearance. You can see the foot clearance down here, and that's got to be 24 inches deep and 9 inches high and 19 inches deep. Well, I guess manufacturers can't understand this, I guess, or they don't understand how to evaluate that. So we're trying to develop a very simplified way to allow somebody to go out and assess these things and to help the manufacturers understand the information so we can determine what is and isn't accessible. So there's an example of one that is pretty accessible. You can see I've got the toe clearance under there. I can get my feet way underneath there. There's a nice deep knee clearance. And so this, by just extending the length on most picnic tables and getting it the right height, that makes it accessible. It's not that complicated. But these guidelines have all been put into the Forest Service accessibility guidelines. They're in their draft access board guidelines, which are going to be integrated into the Architectural Barriers Act, and it'll become law, basically, for anything on federal land. And so we're developing the assessment processes so that when these standards do become law, we'll have the process in place for measuring everything and for disclosing it so people can see where this stuff is. So we set up, what we've done is set up some real simple diagrams to show people how to make the different measurements and to put the numbers in there. They can type the numbers in. It'll tell them, it'll go red if it doesn't meet it, or it'll tell them it meets everything. So we're trying to make it interactive, kind of, laptop type software that'll guide people through doing these measurements. So there's some top view measurements that have to be made as well. And you can see in this data here, it's just kind of interesting because, we had just in our own staff, it was pretty knowledgeable about accessibility. They all measure it, and they all get different measurements. So we're trying to figure out how to make things more easy to make a standard assessment process. So this is my hiking shoes. So when you have a disability, like you talk to Claus or I, we have these garage fulls of stuff because when you want to go do an activity, well, okay, this is my hiking shoes. Oh, you want to go bicycling? Oh, that's an even bigger device, to go hand cycling. So you have all this equipment that you use to go things. So this is my hiking chair. It has disc, four-wheel disc brakes. It can go up and down just about anything if I have some extra muscle to help me up the hill. But we don't want to evaluate things as moderately easy or difficult. We want to give people the actual data to figure out where they can go, and that's where this... Here you can see these people out training in the Universal Trail Assessment process using simple tools, again, measuring length, width, cross slope, grade, surface, and features. And I'm going to show you trail wear a little more. This is what the paper data forms look like when you come back from the field with all the numbers, and then you put it into the trail wear software, and this crunches and processes all the number to generate all the sum reports. And when you get into these summary reports, the land managers really need this information for managing their trails because they've assigned life values, replacement intervals for bridges and retaining walls and all these features and culverts and everything that are on the trail. And so the managers need an assessment for their reasons. People that go hiking want the data for their reasons. There's a lot of different reasons that that trails want to be assessed. So you can print all these tables of data to see how much of the trail is actually over a certain grade. So you can see, okay, there's this much of the trail is over a certain grade. There's 4% of this trail is over 8% grade. So that's not a lot. It probably wouldn't be very hard to go in and retrofit that trail to try to meet accessibility standards. Yeah.
Quick question. I assume the assessment process is a whole process because obviously
they try to measure 20% of their inventory every year is their goal. So that every 5 years, they're sort of reassessing what they have. So here's the digital system. It can be put on a cart, a jogging stroller, or on a roller wheel. So Jeremy likes to carry the computer on his arm and just roll the wheel along and sets it down, and the box measures everything. And we also have it set up so we can do it on OHV trails. There's a lot of OHV trails in Nevada. We've got a lot of BLM land where they drive four-wheelers and stuff out there. And so the system has this box on the front that has the grade and cross slope sensor, and it monitors the wheel sensor. The wheel sensor can measure whether you're going forwards or backwards. And then there's a little simple GPS there and a camera, so we're getting an image at every station. And I'll show you some pictures of what it looks like on the laptop. So we have these bright backgrounds, because when you're outside, it's kind of bright. And so the bright background with the text helps you see the numbers. And it records the real-time information here. You can see the grade and the cross-slope, 5% grade and 2% cross-slope. This is the last station over here. And then you can see the surface is soft and sand and 36 inches wide. So this is my current conditions and my previous conditions. And then we can set alarms. So as soon as the grade or cross-slope changes by a certain amount, it beeps an alarm at me, and I stop and I record another station. Every time the conditions change, you want to start, you re-record and re-record and re-record. And it's very simple, because all you do is hit the button and pull the information. And you do have to let it stabilize for a half a second. The gyros that would let you do it on the fly are, you know, $10,000-$15,000 for those gyros still, like they use in aircraft. And that would put this equipment out of reach for the parks and agencies that need to use it. So, and this is how you measure features. Every feature, like this log, every feature has a length, width, and height, and a remaining tread width. So we put that in. We put in the feature type. We put in there's maybe an embedded rock. And those features all get entered in there as well. We can put the surface firmness and stability in. We can sort the data really easily. You know, you just click on any column, and you can see tread width in descending order. You can see grade, max grades, and you can see right where the worst grades are, the worst cross slopes. So you can create all these reports for the land manager, and that way if they're trying to go do improvements for access, they can look at all the minimum trail widths and see exactly where they are, how long they are, and how much of the trail needs to be widened or how much needs the cross slope corrected. And then we've created the information. I talked about the Trail Explorer website and the trail access information. And here's that, you know, that strip that goes on the fiberglass signpost. And then we've also been making some signs. We usually put those strips on 4x4 posts and put those out on the trail. We've also been making some full panel signs. They're like 2 foot by 3 foot. And this is the information that's on them. This one's got 6 trails on it. And it's color-coded, so you can see all the trail access information is down in the corner of the sign. But for the average hiker, they're just trying to look at, okay, where am I? Which trail am I trying to go on? And where are some of the worst obstructions? So we have some signage on there. This is a steep grade here. We've got a minimum clearance width at this trailhead that might restrict somebody from getting in. So that's how we do the signage. This is another one. So this one's South Lake Tahoe. This one's up in Reno, right by the airport. This one's in a park that has baseball diamonds and stuff. This one's in another park up in Reno. So this up is up on Tahoe Meadows. So we're doing a lot of different signs, and we're doing all this work with the gas tax money. Part of the gas tax money goes back to Federal Highways for the Recreation Trails Program to build trails, and especially trails that meet transportation purposes. So shared use bike paths, those have a transportation component, so that gas tax money can be used for creating these trails for alternative forms of transportation. This is the typical problem with a trail gate barrier that was built to keep motorcycles out, but guess what? I can't get in either. So that's why we're working on these different kinds of trail gate barriers. There's all kinds of things to keep cattle out, kissing gates where you go in there and swing the gate and go out. And this one obviously doesn't work so well for someone in a wheelchair, and everybody else just steps over. They use logs that'll allow horses over and keep the motorcycles out. So there's just a lot of different things. We went to some motorcycle events, and we measured all these things and tested them to see, okay, who can get through this trail gate barrier, and had them all try to get through. We went to disability expo shows to make sure all the powered wheelchair users could get through there. These guys with their motorcycles, they'll flip them upside down, they'll drag them through, they'll take the handlebars off. So it's been an interesting project. What we found is we are designing a thermal, an infrared sensor that can, from 100 feet away, we aim at the entrance to the trail gate, and we can measure if there's a hot motor there. And this is what most of the land managers actually want. They want to see the pattern of abuse that's going on, and they want to go out and catch that person red-handed and end the situation right there. So, yeah. The power chairs.
Yeah. Would you go to the mobility market and say this is a classic chair?
Yep.
It's compatible with this.
We've already done that.
Yep.
So the powered mobility devices meet different performance levels according to their performance. Yep. So they've also added they want us to count people. So we have to have two kinds of infrared sensors because the kinds that count people are very different than the one we're using to detect the vehicles. I'll skip through a little bit of this, and I'm going to move on to the next thing that we're doing with this technology, which is right here.
We have about 15 minutes, Peter.
Thank you. So, Federal Highways, our company also developed a process called the sidewalk assessment process. And we helped write a guidebook for Federal Highways on designing sidewalks and trails for access. And Federal Highways published that in 2001. And now the Access Board is catching up. They've got draft guidelines that are going through rulemaking. And 32 states have adopted the draft guidelines. But to do our sidewalk assessment process, it's very time-consuming. You go out there with a smart level, and you set it down, and you measure the grade, and you measure the cross slope, and you measure the flares, and it's very tedious and time-consuming. We figured out it takes about 10 squats, 10 to 20 per sidewalk element. Talk about a worker's comp claim waiting to happen. So, and if you want to measure transition heights, you know where the concrete is shifted, and there's the tripping hazards and sidewalks, those, the only way to measure that was profile gauge. And then trace it on some paper and measure it. And there's lots of, you know, you write down the wrong units, set smart level can be set wrong, you write down the numbers wrong, whatever. So we're taking our data collection cart and we're writing software to measure sidewalks. And so we're going to create this software and we're adding, let's see if I've got a picture, we're adding a laser to it so we can measure the transition height. Yeah, you guys are already designing this ahead of me, aren't you? So we're putting a laser in there to measure the transition heights, and you set the threshold you're looking for, and it just, it's happy until all of a sudden you cross one that's too high, and you know, go back and measure that one, so you go back and forth on it, left and right, to see where the highest spot is, record it, and go on. So it's a really fast way. We've already cut down the assessment time to 20% of what it takes to do manually. We're got our fingers crossed about phase two funding from Federal Highways for a small business innovation research grant. We think we can cut the time in half again with the laser and everything to really make this really efficient for cities to do this for their cities. So here it's measured a couple transition heights at different distances. So we're doing data collection. This is what our prototype software looks like. A lot of it is, you know, you got to calibrate the thing. You got to turn it around and make sure you're calibrated. You got to calibrate the distance, and we've got to be able to measure things like benches and sidewalk furniture and stuff that's out there. So you can select bus stops, and we're going to have probably 100 different features that you might encounter, from newspaper racks to mailboxes and parking meters. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff out in sidewalks, and things need to be within reach, and the operating forces and all those things need to be correct to be accessible. So we've got, you know, some features mocked up for measuring those and getting all the measurements that are needed to determine an accessibility. This is a bus stop landing to determine if that is accessible. And so it's just going to guide people through to do that. And then this is similar, our prototype is very similar. It's grabbing grade and cross slope as you roll along. But the part that's different about it is the actual measurement of the sidewalk elements. So when you put it on a curb ramp, for example, this is a diagonal curb ramp, it's going to just show the operator where to put the cart. Okay, hit the enter key, you know, put it up here, put the enter key. So it gets the grade and cross up at the same time. So you can see how quickly you can suddenly measure a curb ramp. So again, you know, this is not rocket science for you guys, but you can imagine working it out so it's very user-friendly, that it anticipates every possible kind of element, curb ramp, driveway crossing, median, that you might encounter, and measure all the flares and all the approaches and all the landings and the gutter and the roadway and all the dimensions, because then you can figure out whether something can be redesigned, and then all the data just populates right into the field there. And of course, you know, then you've got it in a SQL database, a compatible database, so agencies can put it into their GIS software to create a sidewalk layer. Most cities, you know, they have sewer layers, water layers. Most cities have absolutely no layers for measuring sidewalks. So this is our prototype sidewalk layer for Carson City. We've got all these little symbols indicate what either the shape of the symbol shows whether it's a driveway crossing or a curb ramp. And then the red ones are all out of spec, and the green ones are in spec. So you can see there's 3, 4, 5 that are in spec, and the rest are all out of spec. So very quickly, visually, and then you click on that element, and boom, all the data pops up, or you can overlay the aerial image. So I'm starting to learn a lot about GIS. We're going to design symbols for all the things to go on the maps. So we have to design a symbol library, which means we have to design a font library. So we've hooked up with a font designer that's going to help us design that and create shape files, which a shape file is either a line or a point or a polygon that you use within a GIS environment to capture that sort of information. So then once you click on one of these, then you get all the data, and that's all the data on one curb ramp, for example, that'll be on there, as well as images of it and stuff. And then you could look at all of your curb ramps, sort the worst ones to the top, and then you'd be able to see where the problem ones are out in the field. We're trying to make sure we can be compatible with different accuracies of GPS, because some, that little $150 GPS is fine. Some need, you know, a survey-grade GPS compatibility, and so special complex things we're going to have to do to get those more accurate programs to talk to each other, basically. So that's what we're working on right now. And I'm just going to exit from that one. Let's see what I got. Another 5 minutes. I'll hit one more thing here. I'm just going to show you some images here. In the 1996 Paralympics, we created a presentation. Let's see if I make this big. Called Tools for Play, which had a lot of recreation technology in it. And so I'm just going to show you some of these images here to talk about some other recreation technologies. This is a horse and buggy that accommodates a wheelchair ramp that flops down in the back. Boardwalks are a great way to create accessibility on trails. Our company has actually built 1,200 feet of boardwalk up in the Tahoe Meadows Trail up on Mount Rose Summit up there. This fellow's using 2 prostheses to cross-country ski. There's an adaptive scubing association, children's toys at the playground. Scooters are being made more and more powerful so they can go off-terrain. This guy's doing blow darts. This is the Statue of Liberty. They have a tactile version of the face so that people that are visually impaired can feel the face if they can't look out the tower and see it after they've climbed up to the top of it. So people that do painting. There's our company is actually sponsoring a project at Chico State, or a group of engineering students working on a better seating system for golfers. You can make a seat that pivots, but that doesn't mean you can golf. You're still going to hit your knees with the club. You need to get people forward, be able to lean forward. You need like a harness that'll pivot or swing or something. So we're working on this as a student project that I'm sponsoring. Pardon? Some of the carts actually have lower footprints than the mowers and stuff. The ADA requirements do not specify that you have to be able to drive on the green. So I think it's just a technology problem, an education problem. If you drive straight across a green, you won't damage it. So if you could figure out your shot and then drive straight across to your ball and stop and shoot and then continue across, you'd be fine. As soon as you try to turn on the green, you would tear it up. So I think there was a class action lawsuit that was just won for golfers with disabilities, and so now all golf courses have to have a golf cart that has a single rider capability with a pivoting seat in the United States. So catamarans, there's an adaptive soaring association on the East Coast, and the Minden Tahoe Airport is one of the soaring capitals of the world. And they have two gliders with hand controls there if you want to come up and fly, do some soaring while you visit next week. this guy's got a trekking wheelchair that has lots of handles to help pull and push and drag this guy along. It's a three-wheeled chair. This is the ultralight aircraft that I have. This is flying over the Santa Cruz coastline there, Aptos, just south. I got a camera out on the wing. And I adapted this hang glider. I have a set up with my wheelchair on my left side. I don't know if you can see it very well, but my wheelchair is to my left. Passenger can actually ride in it as well. There's a lot of adaptive sailing programs. There's one right in the Bay Area here called, what is it? See, wheelchair sports. There's an adaptation for catamarans to make these sling seats on the side of them that you can sit in called a trap seat. There's this class of boats called a Mini 12. And Claus invited me to come represent the United States racing one of these little boats over there in the World Championships in Sweden. And it's like an America's Cup yacht, just shrunk down to like 1/5 scale. And you sit in it, your head sticks out, and you normally use your feet on the rudder pedals, but you can set that up with your hands, and if you use enough pulleys in there, it doesn't matter how strong you are, you can pull the ropes and work all the ropes. And did you come in 23rd in one of those races or something? As a world championship, there were 100 and 200 racers or something, and able-bodied, disabled, everybody was all in it together. So it's a sport that allows tetraplegics, paraplegics, full able-bodied, all to compete together in the same class of event. I think my best race, I was 23rd. So. Or you were 23rd, I was 63rd, something like that. Some more sailing, adaptive canoeing. This is a wave ski that I worked with another student group on at the University of Virginia on. It's a little playground accessibility, hand bike accessibility, three-wheelers, hiking. This is a, Permobil makes an exterior hiking wheelchair. There's a couple companies making hiking, powered hiking wheelchairs. Water skiing, that's a water ski cage mounted on a large ski that you sit in, and it's called sit ski water skiing. This crazy guy went bungee jumping in his wheelchair just to prove a point, Splash. Okay, Murder Ball, Quad Rugby. Some of you may have seen that movie. What's that movie called? Murder Ball, yeah. Yeah, and wheelchair sports with tennis and bass fishing. Cross-country skiing. Jeff Pagel, this guy went over the Sierras, over the road in the winter with Mark Wellman. This was really cool. This was a merry-go-round. You drive your powered wheelchair out, and then you drive the wheelchair backwards, and it spun this thing around and around. Very clever design. And then you went the other way, and it drove off. So it had a ratchet, so it would spin in one direction and let you drive off in the other. Dance. Powered swing, this guy's wife really wanted to swing, and he rigged this up for fishing. I'm sure the brakes work. Catch a big one, you're going with it. It's a couple, double amputee golfing. This is Yellowstone, the boardwalks there. We design all our boardwalks 6 feet wide to give the toe rails and room to turn around and pass, five feet to turn around. Cross-country skiing, when it snows, everything becomes accessible to a sit ski. So that's the last slide. 5:30. Any questions? Oh, you guys are too quiet. I want to let you know, I have on our website is our newsletter, but if you like a real live paper newsletter with our current projects and stuff, there's a couple dozen of them here maybe. You're welcome to come up and grab one of those. And if you're interested in coming to visit, we have a guest house at our house. It's available most of the time. You can come and visit. We're just right on the other side of South Lake Tahoe, about 30 minutes from Heavenly Ski Area. So if you're coming up and you want to visit, or if you're interested in working with us on a project or whatever, just give me your card or your email address, or fill out the internship application on our website and email that in. So it was a pleasure getting to be here with all you, and I hope some of you can join us for dinner, right? Is that open?
Right, yeah. Right afterwards, we're going to go over to Max's Opera Cafe. People are welcome to attend. If you haven't told me already, let me know so we can have somebody go over there and reserve enough table large enough for us. So want to really thank Peter for coming today and presenting to us. It's always a kick to see you, and always, I hate to use the word inspirational, but it is, seeing all the stuff that you and your company have done and are doing, and all the people that you're helping and benefiting. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. If anybody is getting to go up to the Paralympics, I went online. You can get tickets to the opening ceremony for only $30 in Vancouver, and most of the events are $15 or $20 to go to them. And we're going to be giving a presentation on one of our new projects up there at the Seating Symposium. That's on Saturday right after the opening ceremony. We're writing accessibility standards for fitness equipment and fitness centers right now to make fitness equipment, universal design standards for fitness equipment. And we're just starting a new project on working on universal design standards for cognitive impairments and how to design products that are more usable by people with cognitive impairments, everything from cell phones to toasters and smoke alarms. And we're going to develop a rating system for technologies to rate products from a cognitive perspective in terms of, you know, readability and icon size and layers of that you have to work through. And we're just at the very beginning stages of that, so if anybody's interested in helping, there's lots of ways to participate in that through the internet and stuff on that work. We have a survey online right now on that cognitive project, and if you can take 10 minutes to fill one out, it would be helpful. If you know anyone that has a brain injury or head injury or any sort of disability that might be causing a cognitive impairment, and so if you have any possible, maybe an older grandma, if you've got anybody that you know that has issues with operating TV remote controls for TVs and things or whatever, feel free to fill out that survey for us. It'd be very helpful. So thank you. It was great. All right.